Confession time. These past 3 weeks have been a lot for me to keep up with, and I'm a professional news person. There is a lot of news out of this new administration, and it is happening fast. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. So, this week, we're going to give you some news and policy, and some bigger picture ideas to play with in your mind. That means looking at things like what makes a hit. And yeah, I mean music and pop culture, but also what makes a hit idea in politics? And how much do we really like new things? And how much do we like the familiar? As always, you can reach us at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We are going to start the show with our segment Long and Short. That's when we borrow terms from the world of finance. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. And ask our guests to analyze topics in the news. Here to join me this week are Marketplace's Kimberly Adams and Jillian White from The Atlantic. Welcome to you both.
Hey, Lizzie.
Oh, wow. Oh, you're almost in stereo. I want to start, Jillian, I think with your long, which is sort of a big picture thing here, and not just in terms of the news of this week, but really economic policy going forward. Tell us about your long.
Yeah, so I'm long the continued questions about what Donald Trump does and does not understand about economics. So this week, of course, this is pegged to the story that Trump called someone up at 3 a.m. to ask whether or not a strong dollar was good or bad for the economy. And I think people really fixated on this because the idea that the president wouldn't know this talking point or what the consequences are, you know, are pretty terrifying. But I think it comes from this broader concern that Trump has never worked in politics. So I think there's going to be this continuing question of how much does he know and how much of his knowledge of economics is just predicated on his business ownership.
The other side of that, of course, if you listen to the narrative coming out of the White House and Trump's supporters, is that one of the ways that President Trump operates is that he likes to hear perspectives from lots of different people. So it may not be that he does not understand this policy, but that he wants to hear from more voices about, you know, what is the best way to, you know, view dollar policy in this context. But yes, there have been a lot of concerns just more generally about how well Donald Trump is able to implement his plan to run the government like a business because he keeps running into roadblocks doing things from the White House that he did from Trump Tower.
When we look at the Trump business empire and when we look at, say, real estate, it is a very closed business ecosystem, if you want to think about it that way. It exists on deals. These are generally not publicly traded companies. So it's very different than, say, looking at how currency policy affects what, you know, people in the U.S. are able to buy and not buy. I mean, a strong dollar means that, you know, people in the U.S. can buy things from overseas. But, you know, there are also some real downsides to a strong dollar. And I think there is no, Jillian, as you mentioned, there's no overall kind of blanket answer. It kind of depends.
Right. Exactly.
I want to switch to another sort of aspect of President Trump's policies, and that's with you, Kimberly, and you're long because this is what you've been doing a tremendous amount of reporting on.
Right. I'm long on the very long proposed border wall. We got new numbers in a recent story from Reuters that where they're reporting came across a document saying that the Trump administration is estimating the border wall is going to cost a little over $21 billion in 3.5 years to build. Now, that's significantly higher than the numbers that the Trump campaign was floating around during the campaign, but more in line with some of the low ends of the estimates that outside analysts have put out for what an actual border wall, which is more likely to be a border fence, would be.
Well, now, why are you long?
Why am I long about this? Because I do think that it's going to happen. I think there's going to be some kind of version of a border fence under the Trump administration. He's put a lot of his name behind this on the campaign trail. And since he's been in office, I think we're going to see some sort of version of an expansion of the border wall, border fence across the U.S.-Mexican border. Probably not all of it because the terrain just makes that impossible.
But and we should note that you've been down there reporting on this.
Yes, we're talking like, how are you going to build a wall through a mountain? Yes, it's possible, but it's just really, really expensive. So the reason I'm long on this is I think he's got too much behind it to not do it. But I think that the hard, cold realities of economics and Congress are going to block some of it. But that said, I'm still going to go as a sub short on the idea that Mexico is going to pay for it, because according to this plan viewed by Reuters, it's still going to be us paying for it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. I feel like the big question as it gets more and more expensive is how this gets sold to the American people, who will likely have to foot the bill for it.
And I think, you know, that is still very much an open question. Tell us about your short, Jillian, because it's one of those things that can sound wonky, but applies to lots of people.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am short the new fiduciary rule that was supposed to go into effect this spring. So this was something that was coming out of the Obama administration's Labor Department. And essentially what it just said was that financial advisors who are advising Americans have to put the best interest of their clients ahead of their own financial interests. So, for instance,
which I think is something a lot of people thought, you know, was already the case, but wasn't.
Absolutely. So this is something that I think a lot of people were not aware of and thought was kind of already in place. But the fact of the matter is, a financial advisor could legally advise one of their clients to purchase a security, not necessarily because they thought it was the best security for them, but because they thought it was probably an okay security, but also had a really high fee structure. And thus the financial advisor would get paid and the client would probably do okay in the end. So this rule was supposed to kind of reprioritize things so that the client's interest always came first. So one of Trump's first executive orders was a call for the Labor Department to look into this and possibly delay or completely stop implementation. And that is something that I think ultimately he will probably have some luck with. I mean, it's kind of crazy that this law was not already in place. And though there have been some small and local victories, for instance, in Texas, a court just said that they were not going to delay implementation of the rule or they wouldn't support it. I still think it's something that could wind up happening. I still think that at the end of the Trump administration, this rule could still be either lingering or done away with.
Something that's important to keep in mind, the Trump administration still has a lot of weight and ability to slow this down or delay its implementation simply by using the existing bureaucracy. And so, you know, the Department of Labor can indeed slow this down or change the implementation in a way that might allow them to claim a win against the fiduciary rule as the financial industry wants them to. But on the other hand, the financial industry has in many ways already planned for this. So there are several
right.
big, you know, financial institutions that have already changed their policies, and they're not going to go back, especially now that there's so much public attention on this issue.
Right.
One thing that happened to me talking about this on Twitter, I got some pushback from people saying, well, you know, some of the rule does hurt independent proprietors. And I will certainly say there are folks who say that is the case. But yeah, this is a really interesting one to watch, because I think the big companies that do financial advising have already baked this into the cake.
Yep, absolutely.
Kimberly, this takes me conveniently to your short. Hit it.
Yes, a big company that's having its own bit of trouble. Twitter. You know, we as journalists obsessively look at Twitter, especially now that our new president likes to make so many of his policy stances known to the world via Twitter. But the company just can't seem to get it together. And so I'm going to go short on Twitter's ability to turn a profit. I mean, we got recent news. They posted their slowest revenue growth since it went public 4 years ago. And the shares are down more than 10% this week. And it's just that there's so many competitors for the eyes that would normally be on Twitter and Twitter ads. Snapchat, Facebook, YouTube, pick your poison. But Twitter, despite its increasing user base and despite all the attention that President Trump is garnering for the company, it just can't seem to make money.
It cannot seem to make money. How much of that do you think is wrapped up with its, I think what people would say is its abuse problem, where people, you know, can be targets of fairly hurled invective? Or is it just, you know, it's not a great business model?
It seems to be something with the business model, because the same argument could be made for Facebook, and Facebook
yeah.
makes money.
Right. I was going to say, I think part of it is that Twitter's model and all of the issues that they have with abuse kind of threatens its user base a little bit and threatens the growth of that user base. But the business model doesn't seem especially sound, partially because they're just not making use of advertisements in the way that, you know, Facebook or YouTube, as you guys mentioned, are. I don't think they're doing as good of a job of getting ads in front of people and commoditizing that as some of the other platforms are.
I mean, my mother would probably be thrilled if I stopped tweeting. On the other hand, how are journalists supposed to argue with one another?
What void would we scream into?
Kimberly Adams, Jillian White, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Doing the numbers here at Marketplace. It's kind of our thing. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Tony Wagner and Elijah Mills as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Hit it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
$700,000.
That's the starting price if you want to lease a floor in New York City's Trump Tower for a year.
The Secret Service is reportedly considering renting a floor in the tower to run intelligence and surveillance operations during President Trump's time in office.
As with past Secret Service property rentals, the lease would be paid for with taxpayer money. 50%.
Since the election, that's how much more Fox News is charging for ads in its primetime shows like The O'Reilly Factor.
Politico reports that MSNBC's Morning Joe has doubled its rate.
Thanks to his Twitter account, Trump's cable news habit is pretty predictable.
All the heavy hitters have noticed, and they're jacking up prices for an audience with the leader of the free world.
$5.75.
That's how much a cronut costs at Dominique Ansel's bakery in New York City, if you can get your hands on one.
This week, the famed pastry chef told the LA Times he'll be expanding his franchise to Los Angeles.
That'll make LA the fourth city to get a cronut outlet, following New York, Tokyo, and London.
If you want to try one, be prepared to wait in line.
4 hours.
Now we're going to revisit two of our favorite interviews. This next piece captures the essence of our show, where the economy and real life, and in this case, art, come together. Late last year, I visited the Public Theater in New York to speak with playwright Lynn Nottage about her show, Sweat. The play is moving to Broadway. It's set in Reading, Pennsylvania, and centers around a group of workers at a local plant. It touches on race, economics, friendship, and the nature of America. I asked Lynn Nottage what she thinks Sweat is all about.
I think that the play really is about where America is now, where America was 20 years ago, where hopefully America won't be in 20 more years.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you picked Reading, Pennsylvania, which is where this takes place?
I wish there was a better story about why Reading, but I was looking for a city that I really felt was representative of what was happening to deindustrial cities all over America. I had read a newspaper article in the New York Times in 2011 and had said that according to the 2010 census, Reading was the poorest city of its size in America, and I found that very interesting. I found it interesting that it was in the Northeast and that it was so close to Philadelphia and New York. We all have sort of a notion of what poverty looks like.
Yeah.
You know, our assumption is that you're going to go down to the Mississippi Delta and see shacks, or you're going to drive through Detroit and see burned out buildings. But when we arrived in Reading, it looked very much like a mid-sized city with people who were on the sidewalks. And so it wasn't really what we were anticipating. But then around dusk, we were at a gas station. And a car pulls up next to our cars. We're filling up, and the guy's in a convertible, and he turns down his music, and he hops out of the car, and he says, "You guys don't look like you're from around here." And we're like, "No, we're not." He says, "Can I give you a piece of advice?" We're like, "Sure." He's like, "Get out before sundown." And we thought, what is this, the Old West? But what he was saying is that Reading really is a city that transforms after dark, and where, because people are impoverished, the desperation sort of becomes apparent.
How long did you spend there?
Well, we traveled to Reading, and I say we because I went with my assistant, whose name was Travis Ballinger, and a little army of interns. And we probably went on a regular basis for about 2.5 years, trying to just listen and absorb and get a feel for the city.
I want to ask you about the responsibility if you want to call it that, of an artist in a time when America is wrestling with some big, hard things. How do you take that on?
Well, I think one of my frustrations with the outcome of the election is that we as artists weren't as engaged with the issues as I felt we should be. I felt as though there was a kind of passivity in the way in which we were approaching the world and reflecting back. And so I think that the charges now is to be more alert, to be more engaged, and to be more challenging of the status quo. It's really interesting because we always, when we first began interviewing in Reading, we always said, can you describe your city to us? And they always began by saying, Reading was. They always spoke in past tense. And that's what made me sit up, is like, wow, we are in a country now that's looking backward and can't imagine itself in present or future tense. And that's what really pushed me to continue my investigation.
I read an interview where you said when people become desperate, they begin to cannibalize the people who are closest to them.
I think that's true.
Well, what does that mean?
Well, I think we know it's true from relationships that we have in our own families, is that the people sometimes who are closest to us are the ones who bear the brunt of our frustration and bear the brunt of sort of any anxiety that we have. And I think it's true when you sort of reach beyond families and into communities, is that when communities are undergoing some sort of economic hardship, a lot of times they burn their own houses down rather than, you know, burning the corporation down.
I mean, I'm thinking about the relationship between two of the women in this play. One is black and one is white.
Yeah.
And you can feel it even before you see it, that race is going to become this huge fracturing point for them.
I think that that's definitely true. I think that as long as both of them were relatively comfortable, that conversation about race was not one that they necessarily had on a regular basis. But it is the tension that's lying underneath everything. But the minute that their lives are in jeopardy, they turn on each other, which I think is what it's happening now. I think that it's really convenient in the way in which Trump has fractured this country, in that it's turned the white working class against all of the other working class, when in fact we should be united right now.
This play is in many ways about work, but it's set in a bar most of the time.
Yes.
Why a bar?
Because the bar, at least in that community, is where people retreat after work. It's like after standing on your feet for 10 hours a day before you go home, you need that period of time where you decompress, where you want to sit and you have chats with friends. And someone asked me this question, and I realized why a bar, because Ruin takes place in a bar and Sweat takes place in a bar. And why does it keep popping up in my work? When I was a kid, my mother worked full time, and after school, I would travel on the subway, go to this pottery class, and then at 5 o'clock, I'd leave this pottery class, which was on West 4th Street, and I'd go to this bar called Jimmy Day's, and I'd wait there for my mother, and then she'd have two gimlets, and then we'd leave. And I thought, I spent a little portion of my childhood sitting on that bench, listening to people at the end of their day sort of chat and commune. And so I think that it's an environment that I'm somewhat comfortable in. And what, at least that bar, Jimmy Day's, it was extremely diverse. And it seemed like one of the few places in New York where you had people from disparate communities coming together.
There are not a ton of high-profile women who command Broadway stages in the way that you now do. How does that sit with you?
Well, it's been a source of major frustration that it's been so hard for women, and in particular women of color, to get access to the huge stage in the center of New York City. And I'm just really excited, one, that I get to bring Sweat, which is about working people, to the stage, but also that I get to share the season with Paula Vogel, who was one of my very first playwriting professors and who's the one who really sent me on this path of writing. And the fact that the two of us are going to be the only contemporary women that have shows on Broadway this season, I think is just kind of phenomenal. It's phenomenal because, one, it's great that it's happening, but it's phenomenal that it doesn't happen more often.
When I think about the economic model of a lot of theaters, producers want to fill seats. They want something that they know people are going to walk in the door and they're going to go see the revival of Death of a Salesman or View from a Bridge. Great plays, but does that make it harder to bring your kind of work to
and
a big audience?
I definitely think it's harder. I think it's part of it is due to the lack of imagination of a lot of producers, and you see it borne out in Hollywood with all of the sequels. You know, they just don't trust that new material will capture an audience, which is one of the problems. But here's the reality: 75% of the tickets that are bought on Broadway are bought by women. And yet producers still are under this illusion that folks don't want to see women center stage, which is just not the fact. It's kind of a catch-22. They don't know whether it's going to women want to see women because they don't put them on stage. But I know for a fact that with Sweat, with Indecent, which is Paula Vogel's play, that there's a huge audience for it.
So then how do you and Paula Vogel and other people bear that responsibility?
By doing it.
How do you write something that is very specifically about a sort of economic moment in time, but also make it enduring, make it timeless? Or do you care if it's timeless?
That's a really interesting question. It's like, how do you make something that's very much rooted in the moment universal? And I think it's really about investing in the storytelling and ensuring that those characters feel real, they feel genuine. And I sat down to write the play. I wasn't thinking about how can I create something for the future, but really invested in building characters that felt three-dimensional and to build a story that I felt was incredibly compelling. And I think that when you look back at work that resonates over time, it's not necessarily because it's about one moment, but it's because those characters speak beyond the moment, that those characters feel real and they feel familiar in ways that you can't always identify.
You write about really complicated, hard things. The last line in this play, and I'm not going to give it away, is really hopeful. Are you?
Well, you know, I'm an eternal optimist. Even when I was traveling throughout Reading, I was always looking for pockets of resilience and pockets of sunshine. I'm someone who gravitates toward the light. And so I like to leave my plays there because I can't remember who said this, but maybe it was Werner Herzog. He said that as artists, we can always imagine a better future. And so that's what I like to end with for each of my plays, is sort of an offering or an invitation to have a conversation about something that's more optimistic.
Lynn Nottage, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Playwright wants a big audience, of course, but so does a company. And that's just what the vegan fast casual chain Veggie Grill is after as well. It's been successful on the West Coast with 28 locations in California, Oregon, and Washington. Now, after a $22 million round of fundraising, Veggie Grill is trying to expand nationally, planning to double its restaurants in the next 3 years. But is the rest of the country ready for vegan fast food? Veggie Grill CEO Steve Healy joined me to talk about it. Welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You all serve, you know, fast, casual, vegetarian food, and right now you're on the West Coast. How do you plan to expand nationally?
Our plans are to go outside of the West Coast. We're up and down the West Coast today from San Diego up through Seattle. But over the next few years, we do want to bring our brand to the East Coast and throughout the country. Midwest for sure, and East Coast for sure.
I mean, do you think that the rest of the country is ready for a vegan chain?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think it's the growing trend around vegetarian food and eating a veggie diet or plant-based diet or vegan, whatever, however you'd like to describe it, is a growing trend, especially in big cities. There's a lot of our core consumers clustered in those big cities.
When you think about your consumers, who are they?
Well, interestingly enough, yeah, we do attract vegans and vegetarians, but about 80% of our guests don't consider themselves vegan or vegetarian. They're what we call veggie positive. And so these veggie positive guests are guests.
Veggie positive.
Veggie positive, which right. means that these are folks that are mindful about how they eat, and they've made a conscious decision to move veggies, grains, fruits, and nuts, the center of their plate, and other things to the outside of the plate. So they could be flexitarian, pescatarian. They could be paleo. They could just decide that, hey, I don't want to eat red meat. I want to eat more veggies. And I think intuitively people know that eating more veggies is good for you.
Well, this sort of brings up this interesting marketing question, right? Like, are you marketing around, hey, we have great food, or are you marketing around, actually, this stuff is vegan? Because, you know, when you advertise a remoulade, you're not saying it's a vegan remoulade.
Like, sure.
You seem to be leaning more toward just, hey, this is the food.
We're a vegan concept and always will be. And I think our vegan and vegetarian guests understand that, and they depend on us for that. And they know they can come to Veggie Grill, no matter what they eat, it's going to be free of meat and dairy and all those products that define us as vegan. But I think where we come from is we start out with, what do our guests want to eat today? And so we come at it from the food first. And then what we do is we engineer it so that it's vegan. So, you know, we do a lot of product development. We do 4 seasonal menus a year. So we're always looking for what are the interesting flavors and foods that, you know, our guests are looking for, and how can we innovate and be creative and bring them things that maybe are really surprising that they didn't know that they could get at a vegetarian restaurant.
When you think about positioning yourselves, are you sort of aiming for the, you know, Panera slice of the market or the McDonald's slice of the market? Because they're very different things.
Very different. You know, McDonald's, I think, is mass market. So this is food that's inexpensive and you can appeal to a very, very, very broad audience. I think, you know, what Panera's done is they have broad appeal, but it's more for a more discerning guest that wants more of a fast casual experience. I think, you know, we consider ourselves what we call polished fast casual. Our food, it's not easy food to produce. So a lot of times it's on the edge of chef driven. We do have a lot of things in our menu that are very familiar to people, things like our Santa Fe crispy chicken sandwich. But from a quality perspective, starting with quality of ingredients and freshness, and everything's made from scratch, and we don't make the food till you order it. You know, we're aiming at more of the discerning guest that, you know, is very food conscious and wants high quality food, but they also want things that are familiar. So people can come into Veggie Grill and get an order of buffalo wings, and it's that great flavor that you expect from buffalo wings. But on a different occasion, that guest might order a quinoa power salad, which is very veggie-centric. You know, I think we're sort of redefining a genre around our food.
You just raised $22 million in a recent funding round. What's the pitch you're making to investors about why it's a good bet to put money behind expansion?
Well, actually, a lot of our investors really understand trend, and the trend around plant-based eating, especially with millennials and the rising tide of millennial spending, and, you know, vegan and plant-based and all that, which used to be on the fringe, is now going mainstream. So there's a lot of sort of critical mass going on around this movement to eat more plant-based items. You know, I think over the next couple of decades, eating this type of a diet, eating this type of food is going to be more mainstream than probably our carnivorous diet today.
But you don't put that into your pitch to diners, really.
We don't. I mean, we want to be all-inclusive. So sometimes you can attach labels to your food that people can misinterpret. So if you go to market and say we're vegan, that for some folks, if you're vegan or vegetarian, you could say, wow, that's great. Other people that maybe haven't tried Veggie Grill or don't really understand our food might see vegan and go, oh, vegan, You know, some of that vegan stuff I've tried doesn't taste very good. Or, you know, they tend to think about brown rice and steamed broccoli as vegan food or raw food. And so we call it veggie-centric because we don't want to exclude those folks that they just want to eat more veggies and they want great flavor and great food and they don't want labels attached to who they are and how they eat.
Part of your expansion plan centers around airports and university campuses. Why those places?
Well, actually, universities, we've been getting a lot of inquiries because the student population today has a very different perception of veggie-based food, and it's actually based on demand. So you have these student populations that are saying, we want veggie options. That's a big interest there. And then in airports, I think today's traveling consumer, you know, they're kind of tired of, and I run into this myself when I travel, trying to find something that is better for you and is flavorful in an airport can be challenging. So we think there's an opportunity to go into airports because those folks travel a lot.
Steve Healy, CEO of Veggie Grill, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want you to think about the last thing, whether it's a song, TV show, movie, whatever, where you knew immediately, oh yeah, that is a hit. It turns out there's some science behind that. And Derek Thompson has written a fascinating new book about this. It's called Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Derek's also a senior editor at The Atlantic. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Okay, Derek, what's a hit?
A hit is a commercially important success story for a cultural product. So what does that mean? Cultural product, I'm talking about movies, I'm talking about music, I'm talking about television shows, even things like first names and political ideas. And it has to be commercially significant, which is to say that something that just goes really big but has no potential to make anybody any money, I don't really talk about those things as hits.
You go into a lot of psychology in this book, not just economics, but really studying human behavior. And there was one thing that stands out to me early on. Less thinking leads to more liking.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
So there's this great idea from metacognitive psychologists. So metacognitive psychology says, in sort of a hippy-dippy way, we have feelings about our thoughts. We have thinking about our thoughts. Some thoughts feel easy and some thoughts feel hard. So a good metaphor is the idea that, you know, you're walking through a foreign country and all the signs are in a different language and you don't know where you are. And then suddenly out of the blue, you see your friend. And you know your friend speaks your language. And you're like, aha, I can ask you for directions. They would say this is the difference between disfluency, difficulty of thinking, anxiety about thinking, and fluency, ease of thinking. The general rule in metacognitive psychology is that we like things that are fluent. We like songs that are easy to listen to, stories that are easy to follow. But the interesting thing that I found is that the feeling of fluency is strongest when it emerges from its opposite. So imagine that moment in, say, a thriller where you don't know who the killer is and then, aha, you have an idea. You think you know who it is. Or that feeling in, like, a crossword puzzle where you can't quite think of the word and then, boom, it comes to you. They call this moment the aesthetic aha. And I love this. One of the theories in the book is that we're sort of hunting for this across culture. We want aesthetic ahas from our books, from our radio shows, from our podcasts, from our movies.
That was nice.
Thank you very much. We want these moments of discovery because that's where meaning lives, is in that moment between disfluency, difficulty of thinking, and fluency, that aha.
So I want to illustrate something that kind of grows out of that. And I could ask you about it, but I actually want to do it backwards. So we're going to play three clips of songs. The first one, John Denver, Country Roads. That's on RCA.
Country roads, take me home.
And then Elton John singing Can You Feel the Love Tonight? That's Walt Disney. It's from The Lion King.
Can you feel the love tonight?
Last one, Bob Marley, No Woman, No Cry. That's Island Records. Derek, what's happening there?
What's happening here is that you have three songs in three totally different genres, all of which have the same chord structure. So on the one hand, they don't sound anything alike when you just listen to the voice or the timbre or the instrumentation, but they're all doing the same thing. They're all plotting a different route home. And it turns out that across music, we love repetition. We love familiarity, but we like it when it's sneaky. We like it when we don't really expect it. And so to hear an entirely new timbre, an entirely new kind of sound that nonetheless uses the same chord structure, that is beautiful to listen to. That is the right amount of disfluency and fluency, a little bit of anxiety and discovery, but also a little bit of swinging open that door and coming home to familiarity as well.
Familiarity and discovery aren't just resonant, though, in music. I mean, you have something in this book that is explained as the Maya rule. What does that mean?
Maya, M-A-Y-A, most advanced yet acceptable. This was the grand theory of everything from Raymond Loewy, the father of industrial design in the middle of the 20th century. This is a guy who designed the most famous sports car of the 1950s, the modern Greyhound bus. He designed the Coca-Cola fountain, even the interior of the first NASA spaceship. He designed the entire middle of the 20th century. And his concept for how to design for people across the economy with all these different tastes is to say people are torn between neophilia, a love of new things, a need to discover, and neophobia, a love of familiarity, a fear of anything that's too new. And so he was this genius at just designing things that hit this perfect sweet spot of, yes, it's new, but it always reminds me of something else. And I think that this is what a lot of people are trying to do across culture as well. You know, when you're on a radio show, I'm trying to create new ideas that make sure that they hit home for people, that they resonate, to address them with a little bit of familiarity, provide familiar examples. In storytelling, you often find that some of the best, most resonant stories have very predictable structures, whether it's the hero's journey, or the classic romantic comedy of they find each other, they fall apart. And so it's this ability to create new products that are overlaid on familiar patterns that is this incredibly successful pattern across the book.
Does the Venn diagram of the two of those things lead to profitability?
I think so, absolutely. I think that even if you look at technology products, for example, there's that great moment in the Steve Jobs movie where Michael Fassbender is looking at the Mac computer and he says, it has to say hello. It has to look like a face, right? They're introducing this crazy new product to the masses, but he needs it to resemble a person. He needs it to have that element of familiarity in order for people to feel comfortable with it. And so once again, in technology, in music, in storytelling, you see the same pattern.
So to get a little meta on you, a lot of your examples come from the world of music in this book. They are examples that I know. I know what those songs we played sound like. Did you do that on purpose?
Absolutely. I mean, you 100%.
You're using the principles in the book?
You can't not, I suppose. And I guess I use them. There's sort of two meta levels. The first meta level is, look, it's a book about popularity. So all of the examples, by definition, have to be familiar. It's very difficult to pick very popular ideas that nobody's familiar with. But second, you know, I am writing a book that is in a genre that a lot of people are familiar with. That is there's a story, then there's some science, and then there's some theory.
I would call this the Malcolm Gladwell genre.
Perhaps it's the Malcolm Gladwell genre, right. But what I try to do from the first introduction and throughout the book is constantly sort of pull back the curtain and say, I know this is that sort of book. But I also don't want it to be just that sort of book. I want to show you when these tricks are dangerous. So that, for example, when repetition in music is used in politics to create sort of musical rhetoric, it's a very, very dangerous thing. That, for example, the very fact that I'm beginning all of these chapters with stories can itself be dangerous because stories can so easily mislead with their anecdotal persuasiveness. So again, even with the genre of the book, I'm trying to deliver something that is familiar, that people know what to do with, but also at some moment says, now let's step back a moment and realize how dangerous some of these principles can be if applied in the wrong situations.
So I think the second half of the book explodes a lot of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You also talk about something that I found really fascinating, which is just like the invention of the teenager.
Yeah.
As a barometer of cool. Because when we think about culture and what is popular, so much of it, certainly now in 2017, comes from teenagers.
We look to the teens to tell us what to do.
Hashtag teens.
What's so fascinating about teenagers, the concept, is first of all just how new it is. Obviously, people have been turning 13 and 14 for millennia, but only very recently did it occur to anybody that this was a special thing. The word teenager really didn't even take off in popular culture until in the 1950s and after World War II. So why? And there's sort of three levels that I look at. First, education. Before compulsory education, when teens were basically just farmers on their family farm, there was no need to separate teenager from adult. Once you turn 15 and you can use that hoe, you're an adult. Get out on the farm. So you needed compulsory education in order to create a school area where teenagers could come together and create their own separate culture. The second thing that you needed was for Americans to get rich, for parents essentially to give these teenagers money so that they could be their own consumers and have their own marketing power. The third thing that I think is really interesting is that you wouldn't have modern teenagers without cars. You needed cars to allow teens to basically run away from their parents and form a separate culture.
And let's be honest, to find a place to make out.
And to find a place to make out. And this is exactly it. You have to find a place to make out that isn't, you know, the living room. That's how people dated. The woman would invite the man over to the parlor and he would have an awkward conversation with the parents. Cars were terrifying to parents in the 1920s and 30s, which actually strikes me as really ironic because now, you know, we look at Tinder, we look at Bumble, and we say, God, this is so dangerous, people hooking up online. This is exactly what people were talking about in the invention of the car. The car was the Tinder of its time. So you needed all these things to invent the teenager, and now we just think of it as completely normal that, yes, of course, teens are not children, but they are different than adults.
A lot of this stuff that you talk about, it might not happen at all. I mean, there is just such an element of chance here.
Yes, exactly. And I wanted to make sure that that came out in a way that people could understand that this is not a book called The Formula. My favorite story about chaos and luck in the book is Rock Around the Clock.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock.
When it came out in 1954, it was the B-side to a record. No one really liked it. It got a lot of marketing muscle from the label, but only charted on Billboard for 1 week. But this amazing sequence of events happens. Peter Ford, a fifth grader living in Los Angeles, is a huge fan of this new rock and roll sound, and he buys the album. His father is Glenn Ford, a movie star. And Glenn Ford, Peter's father, invites the director of his new movie, Blackboard Jungle, over to his beautiful house in Los Angeles. And the director, Richard Brooks, is like, well, I need this new jump jive tune to kick off this movie that I'm making. Do you have any ideas for songs that can kick off this movie? So he gives them a bunch of bands by black artists, and he also gives him Rock Around the Clock. Rock Around the Clock plays at the beginning of Blackboard Jungle, in the middle, and at the end. And only after the movie came out did it become the number one song in the country, the first rock and roll song to ever hit number one, and eventually the second best-selling song of all time. So there's no formula that tells you, oh, a forgotten B-side played over the credits of the 13th most popular movie of the year will be the biggest rock and roll hit of all time. The only thing that accounts for it is the probabilistic nature of cultural markets. In other words, luck. Some artists just get lucky.
So how does this translate today, where corporations spend a tremendous amount of their time trying to identify what hashtag teens are into? Often it is teens of color. How does that work if you are sitting in the boardroom of a big company?
An interesting example of one way that works sometimes. I went to Republic Records and I watched one of their scouts show me how he sometimes elevates the popularity of one of his new songs. So what he'll do is he'll open up his phone and he'll pull up Shazam, which is this wonderful app that allows you to press a button and you can tell what any song is that's playing over the radio. He went down on his phone. He zoomed in on Victoria, Texas, this tiny little town. And he told me, I asked the radio companies in this area to play this new song, Ride, in Victoria, Texas.
Take off those heels, lay on my bed, whisper dirty secrets while I'm pulling on your hair.
And I can see that lots of people are pressing Shazam when they hear the song. So now what I can do is I can tell local markets, larger markets that are nearby to Victoria, say in Austin and in San Antonio and in Dallas, hey, people in Victoria who are hearing this song are pressing Shazam. You should probably put it on your list as well, on your playlist as well. And so they'll pick it up there. So what he's essentially doing is sort of feeding up popularity by finding a really small network that he can actually control with distribution, where he can actually see an effect. And then he's telling other distributors, I have proof of this song's popularity.
Is what we think of as virality BS?
Yeah, I do think it is. I think that most people think of virality, viral idea spreading the same way a viral disease spreads, that it spreads from me to you and you to somebody else and that person to somebody else, a lot of one-to-one exchanges. But when data scientists actually look at the spread of a piece of information online, it almost never looks like a viral disease with many, many, many generations of one-to-one sharing. It almost always looks more like a bomb fuse with one or two, a handful of moments of 1 to 1 million broadcasts. And there's lots of examples in the book where I show that all of these videos that we thought went totally viral, in fact, had broadcasters, celebrities, publishers who are responsible for the vast majority of their distribution. And I think this is an important point to make, not merely an academic point that data scientists care about, because, you know,
right, if you're a consumer, it goes to the sort of the idea of authenticity, of like what's really getting to you.
Exactly. And there's so much, you know, I think that at a time when trust in establishment news is declining, that our trust has sort of moved from institutions to peers. And sometimes we'll say, well, I saw that article in a lot of different places, so it's probably real, right? Ubiquity equals veracity. But my point is to say, even that which seems ubiquitous because it was purely an organically viral was almost always distributed by a broadcaster. So look to the broadcaster. Did it come from this right-wing site, this left-wing site, this Russian propaganda site? It's really important to seek out the provenance of information, the provenance of those broadcasts, rather than trust that say, oh, well, because it's everywhere, it's probably viral and therefore correct.
There is one sentence in this book that stopped me cold. The most important source of news and information in the world is Facebook.
It is. There's no question. You're living in an age of such distraction and fragmentation that the individual power of any broadcaster has to be diluted by the sheer number of broadcasters that there are. Facebook is a nation of 1 billion people connected online. It has absolutely incredible effects for the news that people see. You know, Americans have never really been utterly and exclusively interested in news, right? People magazine has always outsold Time. But because we spend so much time on these social networks where news can sort of slip in, we can become sort of accidental news junkies. We're sort of surrounded by news bits even when we don't seek them out. And Facebook is the mechanism by which we are surrounded by those news bits.
You, Derek Thompson, are selling a product.
Mm-hmm.
How much of this book is engineered to be popular?
At the end of the day, with something like a book, which is so private, you know, a movie you make with 1,000 people, a radio show you make with, you know, 12 people or so, a book is you. It's you and an editor, but the vast majority of it is you. And so ultimately, it is an audience of one. And you have to sort of find a way to trust that the voice in your head.
You got to get people to buy it.
You do have to get people to buy it. But it's impossible in the writing of every single word and sentence to constantly think about the amorphous world of buyers that you don't know. All I can do really at the end of the day is trust myself to have a sense of, do I think that these ideas are interesting to me? And then hopefully they will be as interesting to other people as they were fun to write.
Derek Thompson, author of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Next week, an in-depth look at Dalton, Georgia, a manufacturing town in the middle of modernizing. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Eliza Mills and Haley Harshman, with help this week from Danielle Stevens. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Jake Gorski is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Satara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.